ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
We're back on the mics for the 2025 Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by our new partner, Morgan & English. I'm Justin Darcy, and joining me today for episode 27 is co-host Taylor Dyke. Welcome back, Taylor.
Hello, Justin. It is great to be back in the hot seat. It's been a while between drinks for us, but super excited to be back for season two.
100%. And joining us today is our special guest, Annette English, managing partner of law firm Morgan & English. Annette plays a vital role in this industry, not only with her legal experience, but also sitting on the board of directors at the Australian Turf Club, which we'll dive into shortly. Annette, firstly, thank you for your support of our podcast for the next 26 episodes. And secondly, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Thank you, Justin. It's very generous for you to have me on. Thank you. And Taylor.
Absolutely, no worries. Now, Annette, would you be able to tell us a little bit about your background and how you first became involved in the thoroughbred industry?
Well, interestingly, my pathway is quite different from most people. I was a child who grew up in the suburbs, and my mother was an avid punter. So from a very, very young age, I didn't get to hear much of anything besides 2KY. My mother used to take me to sport, and I'd have to take the scratchings and late mail in the front of the car. So she actually never watched me play sport. She sat in the car and listened to the races. But I understood how punting worked. I understood who all the big trainers were, but I actually knew nothing about the background of racing. So it was a separate pathway. So later in life, when I was at university, I met my now husband, who came from Scone, and his father was a leading equine vet, John Morgan. And he was completely, I'd never met anyone in my time at university who was embedded in racing. So it was sort of a coming together of minds, but he knew infinitely more than I did. And he was training a racehorse. And I thought that was crazy, because for me, trainers were Bart Cummings and TJ Smith and Hayes. And so I didn't understand that a kid at university could be getting a horse ready for racing. And quite early in our relationship, this horse was being set up for a race at Kembla Grange. And I went down to Kembla Grange and I had a hat on and went there. It was completely not the experience I was expecting. And I had to go to all the bookmakers and put $100 on each of them when the odds were at the right moment, because this was the day this horse was going to win. And I just felt sick to my heart, because all I could think of was, this kid's going to have a horse racing about 200 metres coming home. So when the horse raced, and Duncan Ramage, who you may well know, was also there with us that day. He was a good friend of Daniel's as well, and he can tell you this story. And the horse came around the corner, 1,600-metre race, came flying home, just got beaten by a nose. So I think I got sevens for a place. So I thought that was, it was a sudden moment. I was going, this is fantastic. But Daniel, true to form, was devastated. He just said, never going to get that price again. So anyway, that was the start point, and it's been all racing ever since.
What is it about racing that's kept you so deeply connected, both personally and professionally?
I think the thing about racing, it brings a lot of very, very different people. It's not very homogenous. You have very wealthy people. You have people who are track workers. So I think it keeps it real on one level. I think racing gets a bad rap that it's somehow this sport of very wealthy people. To be fair, if you're training a horse in the city, you've got to have a bit of coin behind you to do that. But as a community, it's a very diverse, interesting space where everybody, no matter where they come from, talk about the same language. And I think that's actually a very rare and a very it's a very human space to be.
From your perspective, what makes the racing and thoroughbred industry so unique compared to some of the other sectors that you've previously worked in?
Well, I think that what I just said is actually really what makes it quite unique. It's interesting also because it's a secondary business for a lot of people. This is where some of the challenges, I think, come, we'll talk about later. But there are people who are obviously very embedded in it as part of their career. But for wealthy people, it doesn't tend to be their main business. It tends to be a secondary hobby business. And I think that's also quite unique. Like, I do a lot of work in other agribusiness spaces, and it is everything, like, you know, the food processing and beef space, it's the work. Whereas this is a mixture of work and hobby and pleasure. So it brings up a very unique space, which brings lots of challenges with it as well.
For our listeners who might not know your firm, obviously Morgan & English based down there in Scone, what is it that Morgan & English do, and how does it support its clients, as you said, both in those racing and agribusiness sectors?
Well, we've actually got an office in Sydney, Taylor, so we actually got the bigger space in Sydney. So we do a lot of commercial clients. We do a lot in food processing and agribusiness space. And I suppose much like racing, there is a sort of our base point in racing came from breeding, and Scone is the second largest thoroughbred breeding area in the world after Kentucky, so that we would have and the contact point. Whilst we do a lot of commercial for a lot of different people, the thoroughbred industry has its own unique idiosyncrasies. Starting from the thoroughbred breeding area, it's a much more commercial space. They're dealing with buying big horses. They're actually big enterprises. They've got a lot of people working in that space. So it's a big business. And like any business, it has quite unique legal issues. And the better you know it, the better you can service it. So I think Daniel, having grown up in racing his entire life, we've bred, raced, adjusted. So we understood the tic-tac in relation to what all those issues really were, rather than just coming, as most lawyers do, from the outside. So as a law firm, that's where we really started. Over time, we've become broader in relation to the other businesses we've developed, which, as we've come across more and more industry-specific issues, we've really tried to cater for what the demands of the clients have in relation to that.
The thoroughbred industry is, of course, seasonal. We've got our yearlings going when our yearlings come through. When our yearlings get sold at the start of the year, and then we go into the breeding season in the second half of the year. What are some of the common commercial or legal challenges that you see in the thoroughbred world? Of course, you know, knowing that it would be very different at both times of the year as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting you should say that, because again, for the three businesses that we have, which are quite thoroughbred centric, we develop a calendar based on that, because we, you know, if you're just quite trying to reach out to clients in the wrong time of the year, you're just not going to get a response. So we sort of really look at, the debt recovery process happens. You know, you see when they're going to need the money, when they can't be giving their attention to it, what that looks like. We really look at, I think, the beginning of the year. You get a whole lot of acquisitions happening, so not just the thoroughbred sales, which are obvious times, but the big transaction, the stallion transactions. So there sort of tends to be a fast and furious period of stallion transactions around the two-year-old races and, you know, that autumn carnival. So we find that that's a very heavy transaction period before to get everything done and dusted for the breeding season. It's also a really nice time in the winter months to try and get people to concentrate on the not very sexy parts that they need to attend to. So if they're not on holidays, you try and get hold of them and say, okay, we need to pay attention to this, because once August starts in the breeding space, they're out of control. In racing, once the spring carnival or the autumn carnival starts, it's very hard to get them focused. And then obviously Christmas, you know, it's people just want to have a break and they're pretty burnt out. So we really do work on, and we have in the firm actually a thoroughbred team who are all diehard racing enthusiasts. So there's a sort of tic-tac with them in relation to things that are happening. It's quite an unusual office. If you don't like racing, you don't want to be there. So there's, you know, we have our own firm horse as well. So rather one of the firm activities. And so the people within the thoroughbred team, they engage a lot with industry-specific events. We send the whole firm every year up to Scone Cup, so that those who are Sydney-based really get an idea of how that works. But we really follow that season. There are very specific issues, cash flow, big transaction. And then you just get normal things happening. So I'm buying a stud farm or selling a stud farm. They're all parts of things that we get involved in as well.
This episode is brought to you by Morgan and English Commercial Lawyers, more than just a law firm. They work like external in-house counsel, getting to know you and your business. With offices in Sydney, Scone and Tamworth, and years of experience in the agriculture and thoroughbred industries, Morgan and English deliver practical solutions that work in the real world. Whether it's contracts, disputes, or big picture advice, they're the kind of firm you want in your corner.
We'll touch more on the racing side of things now. And I guess, how is the business side of racing changing, and what role does a modern law firm such as yourselves play in helping participants adapt to these sorts of changes?
So I think the business world of racing is changing a lot because the stakes are so high. The prize money's high. The ticket to entry is getting increasingly high to get champion horses that you see the yearling sales where they're millions of dollars. If you've got a horse in work, it's a very expensive process. So the stakes are getting increasingly high for everybody. For the trainers, the cost of running the business, the regulation, the animal welfare things are very significant. For all the businesses, employment is a very complex part that a lot of people aren't experienced in, and that causes a lot of issues. So I think there's an increasing pressure from regulation, and most people in the racing industry have come up from an organic racing background, not a commercial background. So that can be quite overwhelming for businesses that just don't even know what they need to know. So I think that's a real pressure, managing the business side, the cash flow, having the documentation in place. A lot of businesses, as I said, because they don't know what they don't know, we get a call when there's a major problem and we ask pretty fundamental questions and they don't have any of that stuff in place. So I think trying to get the racing industry up to speed that this is actually a business and you really need to engage in. And if you haven't done it at the beginning, it's not too late, but you've got to treat it like a business. The handshake days are over.
Now, without getting anyone in trouble here, would you be able to share one or two examples of how good commercial structuring or advice has helped protect people in the thoroughbred industry?
Well, it's boring, but I think the most important ones we see all the time are proper employment contracts. I can't tell you the number of calls we get a day where they haven't had an employment contract in place. Things happen, accidents happen. So I think employment contracts are really important. And it sets up, often if they're on a farm as well and getting accommodation, the terms of what that needs to be can be very tricky once it becomes a problem at the other end. And I think the other one on a day-to-day basis for any of the businesses, if they're transacting without terms, conditions, they're crazy. It's a relatively small setup cost, and they often get a generic one, or they get something offline or that someone's given them, and they haven't really engaged with what it is or what they're needing to do with their business. And when something goes wrong, if we don't have terms, conditions, it just makes the process of recovery or who's doing what very, very difficult. And I think, again, there's a sort of a notion of, yeah, we talked about it, it was really clear, and they said they do that, and we said we do X, and now they haven't done it, and they come to you to sort it out and go, no. And it's not that it's not a problem, that you can't do something because it's not in writing, but it makes it a whole lot worse and a whole lot more expensive and a whole lot more difficult. I think they are the two that we see a lot of.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but we'll dive into a little bit more now. You also run Thoroughbred Recoveries, which focuses on credit and debt management in the racing space. I guess you sort of mentioned before what sort of led you to create that, but could you talk us through that business a little bit more?
Well, it was a GFC and a financial crisis. I think, because we're working in breeding so much, and a lot of businesses were collapsing, a lot of the breeders were obviously having a lot of trouble recovering their payments. So that started as an in-house legal practice. And after it was running like in that space for a long time, I sort of looked at that process as a legal process is expensive, slow, uncertain. And there are a lot of restraints you have as a lawyer in the process of recovering. So we set up a separate business, and the purpose of that business was a lot of the restraints that we would have as a lawyer, we don't have in that debt recovery business. And it means that you can do better deals. The process of chasing people, it becomes a much faster. Our goal is to recover without obviously having to sue. And that's, as lawyers, that's our sort of natural space, and it's a heavy stick that we can use. But if we can do a deal ahead of that, that's our ideal. And I think that took us a lot more into racing. You know, as the law firm, we did much more in breeding, but the debt recovery really has taken us a lot more. We do a lot of work for trainers and a lot of businesses around racing. And the difficulties trainers have is that they generally have a lot of small debtors, because you have micro or small owners, percentages. And it becomes a bit clumsy and difficult. And that process for them and their administration is really, really challenging. And I think the thing that we have found by having a boutique business, there are particular tools that we can use that we know in relation to registering horses on the PPSA, the special provisions, garnishing prize money. And of course, because we're in the industry, we know the people, we know the players. If we don't know them, we generally know who to call. So our capacity to track people down is a lot easier too. So I think also we came to understand, again, the nature of racing was today's debtor is tomorrow's client. And I always say that is one of our chief mottos is, it's generally why the racing industry is reluctant to chase people, because they go, oh, they'll come good at some time, and they've been a good client, so we don't want to go after them. And I think key to what we do, we really try to preserve that relationship as best as possible, so that, yeah, look, we've got to get the money, guys, but, you know, we don't sort of go in and crack the relationship too much, unless we really have to. Sometimes you do, but it's our last resort, not our first resort.
In terms of cash flow, obviously cash flow is a big thing, especially in this industry. It's well known, of course. It relies on multiple factors, whether people are selling horses, whether they're being able to, pay for what they're buying. What trends are you specifically seeing around financial pressures or payment practices within the industry?
There are some people who just know how to scam the system. There's no doubt that there's a number of those, and they're difficult. I think the biggest problem I find in the racing industry is what I would call not so much debt recovery, but credit management. Again, you got the big operators. So there's two sort of levels. You've got people who are really big operators and got very sophisticated systems. And then you've got smaller operators where people have got dual jobs, which is not unusual in any small business. And the problem about that is you've got somebody who's not only doing the invoicing, but then's got to be on the phone trying to chase people and do things like that. And I think what we're trying to see now is that's a real industry problem, in that their process for vetting people, IDing people, making sure that they get the right, the right ID, so that if you do need to go and chase them, we've got something more than johnsmith@gmail.com, which makes it really challenging. So trying to sort of get that sort of material in, and training the industry to get in earlier. And I think that's what we're moving into, rather than just debt recovery, what we call credit management, and trying to get on the, don't wait till the debt's 2 years old. It's really, really hard to recover it then. But if you're sort of getting on a process at 60 days and getting us in as a team, it just keeps the money flowing much better. So I think that's a real, it's tighter. There's definitely no doubt about that. And I think everyone's finding it harder. So the process is faster and is critical.
Now, you're also the chair of Safe Industries Australia, which focuses on safety and welfare in racing and agriculture. How did that start, and why did you want to get involved?
Well, I mean, it started with Daniel Morgan again, because he was the horse guy. As a lawyer, he was attending to a lot of accidents and education on. And as he became more senior as a lawyer, that really became a job for him to do on the scale that everyone wants. And again, it's too expensive, really getting somebody one-on-one to do that. So he went into partnership with a friend who had a lot of horse experience called Daniel Bocock. And they sort of ran that as a sort of small hands-on business for quite some time. my particular love is strategy and scalability. So I really wanted that to become an easier process, a more scalable process. So I came on board probably 10 years ago now and really worked on, okay, this has got to be a process with technology and get scalable. So we introduced an induction platform, and that we do work for big organisations, and they're very customised online induction. So when staff come on, they can do it as an online process. And then there's small ones as well. And we've done work, with the bigger organisations. We do work with Racing Victoria, the ATA, Racing and Wagering Western Australia. So we've got some in that space. We do a lot in the agribusiness space. But the thoroughbred industry is one of the most, probably mining is more dangerous, but mining's better regulated. I think accident-wise, the thoroughbred industry is one of the most dangerous in the country. So it's, again, trying to get that notion of safety embedded as part of their protection, and that common sense, the number of people in the industry, scoff at you and say, well, of course you don't stand behind a horse and do X. It's common sense. And the issue in safety is, whilst that might be common sense for you, it's not common sense for every one of your workers. So that we've got to bring everyone on the journey. So it sort of was a natural fit in, again, a lot of what we do. It's extended from that employee process. We do a lot of employment in the legal space, but it's not strictly legal. It's quite advisory. We do the policies, and we also do have a capacity. We go out and do inside inspections to give people a framework for that. But it's, a very inexpensive program to really get people on the journey for safety, which is a really big part of what we believe in.
As you mentioned there before, and we know working with animals has its risks, particularly thoroughbreds, why is workplace health and safety such an important issue, particularly in the thoroughbred sector?
Well, I think it's not just in the thoroughbred industry. It's a protection across the board of, as a community, we've evolved quite rapidly, I suppose, in the concept of as a boss, you've got a power position, you're asking people to do work, and you've got a responsibility in relation to that. If you're sitting at a desk like I do, the risk is probably relatively low. But when you're dealing with horses that are in the breeding series, horses that are about to race when they're, frisky and volatile, the important part is for anybody, they have a right to expect to go home and go home in one piece. And I think the community expectation, which I think is a good thing, is the employer, just can't wing it and hope nothing goes wrong, because the consequence of something going wrong is pretty catastrophic for them as a business as well. I mean, obviously for the individual, it's bad, but also for them as a business, it's quite catastrophic. If they get prosecuted, it's catastrophic. And I think employees are becoming more and more savvy in that. They are more attracted to businesses that are investing in that. So I mean that as when some employees are making decisions in the thoroughbred industry, they're going, well, they're actually taking it seriously and they're concerned about my health and putting things in place. Where some businesses that are putting them in risk, they're going, well, I prefer not to go there. So when you're competing for scarce resources, I think it's a really, from a business perspective, it's very important. But just from a moral perspective, there's a lot of focus on animal welfare, and there needs to be the same focus on human welfare. So it's an important part of, as I said, any business.
As you said there, employees are getting more savvy in terms of, being able to understand this particular workplace is looking after me in X, Y, and Z way. I guess, how are the trainers, studs, and our other industry operators responding to that need for better safety and the better safety culture and systems?
It's goes from one extreme to the other. You get some people who are very serious, very engaged. They work with us, consistent audits. It's hard to say which ones exactly. Obviously, businesses that are bigger and more financial, they have the extra money to do that. So I think there is a sort of a scalable part in relation to that. And then there are some people who, again, completely disengaged in it, don't understand the risks to their business, their employees, and really, really difficult to get them engaged. And I think the difficulty with that is we get a lot of calls. We do a lot of crisis management and catastrophic assistance. And it's really tragic when you're getting that call and seeing these things could be avoidable. It's a broad spectrum from zero to hero is what I would say. But I think definitely there is I think it was seen to be a bit weak when we first started. You know, this is a bit of a ticker box exercise. I think the legitimacy of that as a necessity for businesses is definitely growing.
The Brisbane Racing Club, Queensland's premier destination for horse racing, events and world-class hospitality. As a Brisbane Racing Club member, you'll enjoy exclusive perks and unforgettable experiences at one of Australia's leading racing clubs. Unlock unlimited members reserve access across Eagle Farm and Doomben, including the thrilling 2026 Stradbroke season. Join today at brc.com.au and feel closer to the thrill, prestige and excitement of Brisbane's thoroughbred racing scene.
We'll move on and we'll talk a little bit about the ATC. Obviously, you started your tenure on the ATC board in February of this year. It's been a very busy 12 months, especially in the world of the ATC and Racing New South Wales. Firstly, what motivated you to get involved with the board?
Well, I was asked by some industry participants. It was really in response to Rose Hill. I think, you know, my legal background and my experience across the whole industry, and obviously, you know, a lawyer, people think at least as a lawyer you can sort of think on your feet and do things. So I really was pretty naive in relation to what I could do and the contribution in relation to that. I think the position in relation to Rose Hill, there was obviously a divergent opinion in relation to what that should be and if it should be sold. I have to say at the beginning, I really didn't have a strong opinion either way. My perspective was really, and when I was running for election, was why. And, you know, why does it need to be sold? And what is the purpose to serve? And if it is sold, what is the impact? And I think that was really my focus throughout the whole process, is why, and if it is sold, what is the consequence? And I think that was, and obviously the members were very strong in what their position was in relation to that.
As you say there, member support's certainly something that the ATC very much prides themselves on. I want to strip that back to just a simple question, I guess. What exactly do you see is the ATC's role when supporting its members?
Well, I think that's, again, you know, when we're talking about the changing face of racing, and I need to be careful, obviously I'm speaking on my own behalf, not on behalf of the board. But I think this is one of the challenges for racing full stop. You know, there's been a massive challenge for racing in its social license and its legitimacy. Obviously anything in relation to working with animals has a lot of question marks on it, and particularly cruelty if that's perceived. So I think this social license for racing took a bit of a hit. So I think the part of the ATC has been, it's in its new form, but racing is a really strong historical story in Australia. As I said, you know, as a little girl in the suburbs, I was part of it. It's part of, it has almost a mythical position. So the ATC is partly a custodian of that, I think, you know, the story and the people and the trainers. So I think it holds a custodian position. But I think the challenge for the ATC and racing has been to get a modern voice in that, bring people along for the journey. The ATC puts the show on. You know, we've got the track, we've got the people, and it's trying to engage the relevancy of where that is, not just for, you know, us oldies who've lived that as a part of our youth or childhood. But there's a lot of competition and a lot of noise for different sports now. And I think the fabric of people's lives is very different. You know, you've got both parents that are working. Weekends are very hard to do anything social because you've got kids' sport. And then you're competing amongst a lot of sports that weren't really around before. So the challenge for racing and the ATC is to carve their voice out. And you've got to offer an entertainment experience. And I think that's what I find really fascinating and interesting for the future, is racing really defining its narrative and its story, and becoming a substantial player in the entertainment space.
In you saying that, I've noticed myself that ATC are doing a great job with their marketing towards the younger Gen Z demographic. They're all over my social media feeds at the moment, and they really seem to be appealing to that next generation audience in a great way. They're using the right influencers, they're getting the right people on board, and creating some really great content that if I was just a person in the Sydney city, I'd be intrigued to go and check out what it's all about. Is that something that the ATC is really putting a heavy focus on? We know, like, if we don't engage the next generation, we're not going to have an industry. So it seems very important.
Absolutely. I think that's part of what the Rose Hill debate really highlighted. I think both sides of that debate were bringing legitimate issues that were putting a lens on, well, what is the future of racing? And if you want a future, you've got to really work for it. You know, I think there was a bit of complacency about what we had and the expectation for that. We have a sensational management team at the ATC. Every time I go to a board meeting and go to the races, I just congratulate the quality of the show, the quality of what they're doing. And we talk about the engagement a lot, who we want to be approaching, how that needs to be done. And they've really got a lot of ideas. Again, it's not just about people who love horses, it's getting a space in the social fabric. And I think, yeah, I think they're doing a great job. And our numbers are showing that as well. The Everest Carnival, which is a great collaboration, you know, Racing Nelson, the Everest Carnival has been a great addition to the carnival. And it's now sold out. So to have a sold out event at a Sydney racetrack is a sensational achievement and very exciting.
You talk about the Everest there, and what a remarkable race day that's become, and largely because of this, you know, the multiple marketing sectors that the ATC has taken to promote this as well. You know, Racing New South Wales as well has played its part. We get to see Kaying Rising, world's best sprinter. That's been heavily promoted and even reached mainstream news, and it really is putting racing and the thoroughbred especially at the forefront of both the general public and for our industry participants. It must be a great feeling to play a big part and be involved in that process.
It's really, I mean, this is my first year in the official role with the ATC for the Everest, and it's blowing my mind. There's so much on. This week is like a whole carnival week, the activities. I hear from even people in Melbourne, they're saying no one's talking about their races, they're talking about, everyone's talking about the Everest. So to create that sense of history in such a short amount of time and enthusiasm is, you know, a credit to everybody who's involved in that. It is a huge event. The marketing team, the experience. And I think next week I'm really looking forward to seeing that on show, because it's a lot of work. I think people realise when they turn up to the races, they're starting that race day on Monday. You know, they're getting everything ready. And this carnival's been in the, you know, planned for months. So it'll be a really exciting experience. And Kaying Rising, I mean, he track worked last week, did the barrier trial, and there were 1,000 people at that just watching the barrier trial. I mean, it's great to see. We've got the best numbers we have had for quite some time at the races, the enthusiasm, the experience, the number of young people coming to the races. It's really great to see. And I think, as Taylor says, the engagement with the broader community is really an exciting development.
Now, in terms of you obviously just joining the board this year, what's been the hardest part about joining it, and what challenges are you facing, whether it's on a weekly or daily basis?
Well, I think, and again, I've obviously, you know, I'm speaking personally and not so much from the board perspective, because obviously I can't speak about a lot of those things, but the Rose Hill debate was challenging. It was big to land in the middle of that because it was quite polarising. And I think that, you know, as I said, I think a lot of healthy things came out through the discussion from both sides. And I think that was challenging because it was like a for or against narrative. So I found that quite challenging, because it that from a lot of perspectives puts people in a yes or no camp, and I don't think it's much more complex than that. I think now now that that's finished, that dominated the narrative for quite a long time. And I think the challenge now is the re-engagement. Well, what is the next stage? The challenges that were raised in that time, how do we address them? What is the future? How do we, all the things I've said, how do we compete as a sporting event? With all the, we've got massive infrastructure, got massive costs, we've got a whole lot of social license issues. So I think there's important work to be done to take the ATC into the next stage. And I think part of that is, as I said, part of the challenge is the old-fashionedism, the historical part of racing, where people love what it was and the traditional part. And I think there's a love for that traditional part. But to remain relevant, you've got to change some of that as well. So it's a very delicate balance between managing the history of racing, managing the love of the horse and the focus on the horse, but engaging with the broader audience to make it an economically viable and social license in the for the future.
As much as we would love to, but without going into any internal matters and current politics, what is exciting you most about the future direction of the ATC?
For me, I love strategy, and I love to grow a business. You know, that's, and I think what I see, what really excites me, is there's so much opportunity for the ATC that is already there. They've got incredible infrastructure, incredible passion, and I think it's a revitalising engagement of a lot of things that probably a lot of people in racing don't see. You know, I think the opportunity with tech is enormous. To really scale a lot of the client or the member experience and the general public experience to racing. So I think with keeping costs contained, I think that's a big thing. I see, you know, when we're talking about strategy, one of my, you know, visions for not wanting to be too ambitious was that I saw the ATC, unlike other states, has all of the metropolitan races under its management. And I think that gives a really powerful opportunity for, and with the, you know, work with the Everest and the support we can get from Racing New South Wales, it gives us the opportunity to be the world leader in racing. And I think that tiny little ambition for me is actually what I see I want to have. I want to see racing in Sydney, the premier world racing. Anybody wants to come to Sydney, they say, going to be on their bucket list. I want to go to racing in Sydney because I hear it's the event. And that's really what keeps me motivated. I think that's I think once we can get past sort of more political issues, if we can get to that, I think that's a really exciting space for us to land.
Absolutely. That is what it's all about. I want to talk a bit about a general look at the industry here. From your perspective, what are the big issues currently facing the thoroughbred industry?
I think the polarisation of pricing, I think, has become a really big issue. So you've got really big race, and that, you know, it's not to demonise the people who are doing that because they actually are driving a lot of the economic value in the business. But it's very expensive to get into a racehorse now. It's very expensive to train a racehorse. You know, I've seen some of the major races and I'm going, how can you only have 7 horses in that? So making sure that the fields are big enough and that's quite a systemic issue. And so that starts at a grassroots level. And I think there needs to be a greater understanding of from breeding to racing and all the roadblocks, all the costing that becomes problematic. We've certainly seen in the breeding side, you know, these stratospheric costs in relation to the champion ones, but that middle part is really struggling. And I think without that middle part, you won't have enough feeding into the racing. So everyone loves to see the superstars, and that's great. But the superstars have to be superstar against something, and that's a whole breadth of industry that needs a support. And I think that's really one of the major challenges we have at the moment.
Transparency and governance has never been so important in today's day and age, especially in this industry. How important is it to maintain the public's and participants' confidence within the industry?
Well, I think actually compared to the old days, I think, particularly I really talk about New South Wales, I think they do a really good job of that. I think I don't think there is the question mark of dodgy races and drugging like there used to be. I think there's much more confidence in the process. So I think there's been a lot of work that's been done with that. And I think our regulator does a lot of, you know, work to make sure that that's done. So I think we actually do a really good job of that. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I think when something happens, they get on it, and the mechanism is there to make that happen. So I think that's a really good thing. I think the future, you know, I think we really saw a lot of pushback in relation to, you know, the nature of racing, and I think we need to be better telling that story. You know, I think a lot of people criticise racing and the welfare of horses, but they've never actually experienced racing or seen it. And, you know, I'm embedded in it. I see people, they love horses more than their own children. They're treated like gods, they're superstars. So I'm not saying nothing ever goes wrong, but it's a small, not the story. And I think that's what we need to start getting better at. I think we need to start sharing that story in it with a much stronger narrative rather than keeping it in-house. Anyone in the industry knows the story. So we talk amongst ourselves and we just know it, and we get resentful when anyone pushes back. But I think that's a failing on our part in relation to how we communicate that story.
What would you like to see the industry doing differently over the next 5 years?
I think, this is going to sound, I don't know how this is going to land, but I think they've got to grow up a little bit in relation to it being a business. I think and I said, that's across the board, but there is a bit of immaturity in relation to, we've always done it this way, and he's going, the world doesn't exist like that anymore. And if you're physically struggling, get in early. There's a whole lot of things from a business perspective if you can do. And I think a lot of people are in the horse business because they've been doing it their whole life. They love horses. So they're a great technician in relation to their horse skills. But to be a good horse person and understand horses is very different from being a business person. So just to go, oh, I love training horses, I love horses, I'm going to train one, is very different to then having to get out there, get the clients, you know, ensure that employees are good, work health and safety, your financials are good, you're doing your taxes. It's a whole raft of things. So, yeah, and maybe that as an industry, I think there needs to be a coming together that maybe does a bit better training in that. We've been doing sort of informative with our clients, associated affiliates. We just did one with the hunter breeders day, you know, a four-hour seminar, where we brought both the whole three entities in about how to run a good business, and just trying to say these are things that you just got to turn your head to. And I think that education and the willingness to participate in that education needs to get better.
No, that makes complete sense. We'll dip into our last segment here. We like to call it our fast five. So these are just five questions that we'll throw at you. First answer that comes to your head, and we'll accept that as the answer. So Taylor, I'll throw it over to you for the first question.
With all of the different hats that you wear and all the different things that you've got going on, I'm sure it is extremely stressful. What's your favourite way to de-stress?
Wow, I wasn't expecting that one. I actually really love going to the races. So that's the thing that being on the ATC has been a fantastic addition, which I really wasn't expecting. My husband loves the races. We bring guests and we go a lot now, as you can imagine. But that really is enjoyable, and we're really embedded in that community. So that's great. And I do yin yoga every Monday night. So that's my holistic part of that.
If you can possibly take your ATC hat off here, in terms of any race meeting in the world, what's your personal favourite?
Well, I went to Ascot last year and it was sensational. I think that as a and I took a lot away from that for ideas for the ATC. So I thought it was on different league. It was fantastic. I haven't ever been to the Melbourne Cup Carnival, so I really look forward to doing that. I thought I might get there this year, but our Sydney Carnival is getting bigger and bigger, so my hat's there. So the Kentucky Derby as well. But I don't think that as an experience comes close to what we deliver, to be quite honest. So I think Ascot, and I think I'll be looking forward to next week. I think the Everest will really be on steroids as well. So I'm going to put our hat up for us.
If you could have dinner with three people of your choice, dead or alive, who would they be?
Well, I think, interestingly, which would be quite contentious to say, but I actually wouldn't mind having dinner with PVL, Peter Volandis. I think, you know, we've got interesting different positions, but I clearly he's had a very entrepreneurial focus on racing. And I think, you know, maybe we'd have more in common than not. So I think that could be an interesting focus. Anthony Albanese, I really like. I really think his growth into a prime minister from where he's come from has been a very interesting journey. And I think, again, a small dinner with him would be a very interesting one. He seems to be very grounded. And I think the Queen, who has died for a dead person, I think interestingly, she was someone who had a very fixed public persona. And I think, you know, seeing her interest in racing was the chink into that. And I think having a few gin and tonics with her, watching the Saturday racing with the form guide, and having sort of a light lunch is probably what I'd want to do with her.
I have to say that's one of my favourite answers that we've had to that question. If you didn't work in the thoroughbred industry or law, where would we see Annette English?
I love interior work. I had an interiors business for 8 years, and I really that's my passion sport. I always wanted to be a property developer. Just, you know, I don't really enjoy doing it for others so much, but that's my love space. So yeah, I think that's what I would do, or run a big corporation. I wouldn't mind doing that as well.
And finally, what is one piece of advice you would give to someone looking to pave their way into the industry?
I think what I would really recommend that anyone who does in racing, which I think the Flying Start program's been very good at, is become a good technician. If you're going to become a jockey, then train with the best that you can possibly do. Try and get the best races. If you're going to get into the law part, train with the people who know that part. I think there's a lot of average performance, and I think if you really are dedicated to what you're doing, work at getting to know it, in this industry I think you'll stand out, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for that. They're looking for really good talent and really smart people, and I think there's a lot of big businesses racing, you know, got Racing New South Wales, ATC, so you've got administrative spaces. So even if you're in marketing, I mean, gosh, you couldn't be in a better space than the ATC for that. You know, as you said, incredible, or hospitality. So there's a lot of big scale. And I think if you really worked at your craft, no matter what you're in, if you love racing, there's a lot of space and a lot of really good business people there to work with.
Annette, thank you so much for coming on this podcast today. We're stoked to have you on to have Morgan and English on for 26 episodes. We've really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit more and a little bit about what you do, obviously wearing so many hats within the industry. And again, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. My pleasure.